In 2005, I met a young, punkish woman wearing a daring t-shirt just outside a San Francisco hotel. She had just authored a book called The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own. She had agreed to appear on the 7th episode of a strange new podcast called The Bat Segundo Show.
It's the tone that's most natural for me. I mean, I don't think I set out to write a memoir even.
Oh, really?
Per se, but I mean, I didn't have some clear idea that, oh, I want to write a personal book or a political book, but I think it's just more natural, I mean, authentic, actually, you know, it's sort of
gotcha.
Comedy.
A few months ago, I learned that this woman, Periel Aschenbrand, had written a new book called On My Knees. An excerpt from this book concerning Philip Roth recently appeared on Salon and attracted quite a bit of controversy. I was more curious about how Periel had changed over the last 8 years. The prospect of doing something on radio along the lines of Michael Apted was just too interesting to ignore. And now that the Bat Segundo Show has returned in weekly earnest, I'm hoping to do more of this as the show goes on. So I met up with Periel at a club where I was not a member. Periel was now married and very, very pregnant, and our conversation became amicably and mutually fiery, especially when I started challenging some of her conclusions, and she started challenging mine. Okay, so I am here, once again, with the lovely Periel Aschenbrand, who is most recently the author of On My Knees. Periel, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. This is the rare case where someone who was in the first 10 shows comes back 7 or 8 years later and is now here in the flesh, but we're much different people, I think.
I would imagine so.
Well, maybe how have you changed for people who aren't privy to your developments? You're expecting, I see.
I am expecting. So that's a huge difference. And
but you've always been expecting in some sense, I think.
Expecting something, right? Always expecting something. In terms of the book or in terms of me personally or both?
Whatever. The nice thing is there's a lot of latitude here in terms of what
yeah,
we talk about.
I mean, I think that I have sort of the wisdom of experience maybe behind me, which is to say that I would have done everything exactly the same.
No regrets. We'll talk about this. Okay, so let's get into the book. You say that from a very early age, you knew that you were in the wrong borough.
Yes.
You also write that the last thing in the world you wanted to do was move to Brooklyn. You even say, I hadn't clawed my way out of one outer borough to move to another. I have to ask, speaking as a loyal Brooklynite, what's so bad about Queens and Brooklyn? Why are you dissatisfied with the way you grew up? Why should Manhattan matter so much?
Well, I think I'll probably enrage a lot of my friends, most of whom live in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I think that there really is something to the magic of Manhattan, especially when you grow up in Queens and you see things are extremely different on the other side of the bridge. It's where it all happens. I mean, it's like that's where I saw, you know, the drag queens at Patricia Field transforming at like age like 14. I mean, it's where you see the nightlife and the skyline, which is still exciting to see every time I land here, even after, you know, like 100 million times of seeing it.
But a skyline is not necessarily borough specific.
It's a skyline of Manhattan, specifically the skyline of Manhattan. I don't know. I think that there's a magic to it that anything is. I mean, I still think anything is possible here. I mean, if I was able to get out of Queens, anything is possible.
Wait, anything is possible even though Manhattan is widely considered by many to be a playground for the rich?
Well, now, yeah. I think I still have the that sort of nostalgia for what it used to be, or the sort of love, the same love that I had for it when I was a kid, sort of wide-eyed and starry-eyed for it. I think Manhattan has changed a lot, and not necessarily in great ways. But
so you're operating off of a sense of Manhattan, as opposed to...
I think it represents something. I mean, it's a conceptual thing. I can obviously recognize that there are beautiful parts of Brooklyn and it's a lovely place to live and all of those things. But for somebody who grew up in Queens and spent her entire sort of childhood dying to get the fuck out of there, you know, when people from like Wisconsin come and start like talking about how amazing Brooklyn is, it's a little bit difficult for me to get on that ship.
Oh, really? So actually you're courting some jealousy perhaps towards my lovely borough, I must say, which is a little more welcoming. You can walk anywhere in a 4-mile range and be in a totally different neighborhood, whereas there are wide swaths of Manhattan where it's just, you know, especially like the Upper East Side, where it's the same thing for a long while until you actually get to the cool stuff that's like, you know, about 100, you know what I mean?
No, I think Park Slope is like the Upper West Side at this point.
There are some dives in Park Slope.
On the Upper West Side.
Still.
I don't hang out on the Upper West Side, actually. I have no idea what's going on the Upper West Side. But I think that, like, this romantic notion of the boroughs is probably as ridiculous as my romantic notion of Manhattan. And I think that's really sort of what it comes down to for me, that... to hear like Brooklyn and Astoria being lauded as these like amazing places, well, very well may be the case. It's really hard for me to wrap my head around.
Not tendentious or anything. Well, okay, so you write that you thought that you knew everything at the age of 22.
Mm-hmm.
How have you curbed yourself of this impulse in the subsequent years? I mean, how do you contend with sometimes not knowing anything?
Now I'm sure at 37, I'm sure I know everything. No, yeah. I'm just kidding.
I'll start quizzing you on Ulysses. I was talking about that off tape.
Intellectual
modality of the... Okay.
Well, I totally missed that. I think that I take sort of great... I mean, I think that it's a good thing to recognize that there's a lot that you don't know. But I also think that that sort of self-assuredness and... hopefully not too much arrogance, but maybe a little bit at that younger age really helped me. I mean, I think it served me well. I mean, I think that I had like a good enough head on my shoulders not to think that and be a complete idiot. I think that it's very possible to like think that you know everything and also just be really a moron.
Yeah.
I think that, I mean, maybe I've become a lot more humble in my old age.
Really, even though you were introduced to Philip Roth as a great writer, and you have to unfortunately shake off this regrettable notion, being told that you're a great writer to an indisputably great writer.
Well, he didn't say I was a great writer. So.
But you didn't exactly talk yourself out of that after your
mutual friend.
Well, no, why would I? Well, if someone had introduced me to Philip Roth, uh-huh. and even if I was a woman or whatnot, uh-huh. I would say, you know, they're just kind of talking something. They're uh-huh. talking me up a little uh-huh. bit. I know you're the man. Uh-huh. At least that would be me. But right. you did not disavow yourself.
No,
of that
no, no, absolutely, no fucking way.
Why?
I totally
Why?
Went
Why?
With it.
You're on the level of Philip Roth.
No, I don't think so at all. But I think that I don't think that those things are mutually exclusive. I don't think that I can't be really good at something that he is. I mean, I don't even think like you can compare, like, I mean, I would say better. I mean, it's ridiculous. Like, he's Philip Roth, you
yeah.
know. But that doesn't mean like I can't also be a great writer in my work, you know. I mean, I don't think that those things are mutually exclusive at all. And I don't think that like I myself would ever articulate it like that. I think like I'm proud of my work and I stand behind it and I think I'm pretty fucking good at what I do. Why should I not own that, especially if I'm being introduced to him?
Well, why actually ascribe a modifier like great to yourself?
I didn't.
Okay, or at least play up that. I mean, there were Gatsby thought he was great or was thought to be great, you know?
Well, he was right.
So that's very much sort of is how you operate, that you need to put yourself at a high echelon on in order
I didn't put myself there. I did not go.
Even though you said that you knew everything and that you're still sort of abiding by that even now.
No, I said that at 22, I thought I knew everything and that I've become much more humble in my old age. And that if somebody is going to give me a compliment, which is how I was introduced to Roth.
Yeah.
I'm going to say thank you and accept that compliment and not deflect it.
Yeah.
So, and again, like, I stand behind my work, and I would never in a million years introduce myself as a great anything to anyone. Like, I think my work stands for itself, and if somebody wants to laud it, like, I am, like, graciously accepting of that compliment.
But after the man put cherries into your mouth, you then sent him a huge crate of cherries, and you expected him to reply, and you did not get a reply.
Correct.
And you waited weeks and weeks and weeks for this particular
Years at this point.
Years.
I'm still waiting.
So I guess you and I have to figure out how he can actually reply. What do you expect? Just a thank you note or something more?
Yeah, I did. Okay. That was it. Just like a small, like, acknowledgement of, I mean, the same way I would expect from any other human being in the world.
So if you sent a big crate of cherries to, like, the White House, you would expect a thank you note from Obama?
If he had been feeding me cherries the week before, I would.
So because there was the actual feeding of the cherries and that there's this continuity, there needs to be some kind of, you wanted resolution on the cherry feeding.
No, I just think it's a normal thing to do. I mean, I didn't, like, ingratiate myself to him. He asked me to sit down.
Yeah.
I mean, we were introduced by a mutual friend. It's not like I'm, like, some, like, weird fan who, like, showed up at his house. As said in the book, you know, I actually was not familiar, which is the onus is on, that was my bad, and I take full responsibility for that. But, I mean, yeah, it's normal. Like, I don't care who you are, if you're Barack Obama or Philip Roth, like, we had dinner, like, I sent you something. It's a normal thing to do, to say thank you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and in fact, I've actually had this discussion recently with another writer about how thank you notes are starting to decline in our society. Even by email, people don't say thank you anymore. What do you think? What do you think of that? I mean, is this a way of kind of upholding a set of dying virtues, or is this kind of emphatic need for a thank you note a way of kind of carrying on a tradition? Would you say? Or?
I always send a thank you note in the mail.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe I'm more old fashioned than I give off.
Okay. You note that your grandmother taught you to stick up for yourself and not to take no for an answer. But I must point out that life is about compromise, and as you also write later in the book, most of the time things don't work out how you think they will. So what do you do when somebody tells you that you can't get what you want? I mean, do you feel dejected? Do you blame yourself? What happens here?
I think that life is about compromise. I do agree with that. In certain situations, I think that I'm talking more about, like, going after what you want and what you believe in and not taking no for an answer, and that you can achieve anything you want if you are willing to fail multiple times and work hard enough to get there.
Well, I mean, have you ever quit something that you aspire to do? Because a lot of people generally find as they get older that they're good at a couple of things and that there are a couple of things they really want to do, but that they have to kind of cut it off because it's just like, well, clearly I'm having success at this. This is what either people want, or this is how I'm actually getting paid to do this or whatnot. I mean, have you had things that you've had to abandon over the years that you wanted to do more of or anything like that?
I think it really depends on what you're personally willing to compromise, to go back to that sort of idea or word. I mean, I think for certain things, I mean, you sort of have to be willing to risk everything to achieve and be willing and ready to fail multiple times. And I think it depends on, like, how much it means to you. You know, I was just asked this question, what advice would I give to young memoir writers? And become a banker or something, unless, you know.
I think old writers say that, don't go into writing, because by the time you're into it, it's too late. Yeah.
Like, unless like you live and breathe to do it, you know. And I mean, I'm really not that qualified to do that many things. things.
What have you failed at? What do you think is the biggest thing that you've attempted that just you fell on your ass big time?
I don't think of things in that context, actually. I'm sure there are a ton of things that I've failed at, but I mean, for me, I really try to make everything sort of a learning experience or like a stop on the way to where you're supposed to go. So I have very few regrets, to tell you the truth. And I feel very fortunate for that. But like, there's nothing in my life that I'm like, oh God, like I fucked that up so badly. Maybe the cherries. Maybe there was a better way to do it. Maybe I should have gone home with Philip Roth.
Well, you did say that in the book. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So
that was a pretty big
You could have parlayed failure. That into something a little bit more of a consummation. Of so you wrote about Body's Billboard in the last book, which we talked about many moons ago, The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own. Yet you don't really touch upon your work at House of Exposure in this book, which I found really interesting. And I'm wondering why, at least in this memoir, you felt compelled to kind of corral the personal instead of the professional, because a lot of memoirs of this type, I've read quite a few, will get into, well, I was doing this and I was erecting this massive church in the middle of nowhere or something like that. So, but you didn't do that. So I'm wondering why you focused more on, oh, say, some of the apartment battles that you had and all that.
Well, I think that what motivated me to write The Only Bush I Trust Is My Own and to create Body as Billboard was political. And what motivated me to write On My Knees was personal. So it wasn't, I don't think it was so like well thought out. House of Exposure is wonderful and I love it and I feel so lucky that I get to do it. But it, first of all, it didn't exist when I started writing the book. I mean, it was sort of an idea. But I think mostly it just wasn't the thing that was, you know, I mean, I say, you know, I'm sort of like the vessel through which these books get written, you know. I mean, they sort of...
The vessel.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, like, come up with, like, some, like, outline and, like, I want to say this and I want to say this and I want to say that. So it, like, really happens, like, pretty naturally. I mean, the things that are sort of come.
I'm getting this weird like image peeing. Of you at Periel as this sort of glass of water who fills, he's like self-filling glass of water. The water goes to the top, then that actually gets drained into the book. Am I saying vessel
that's,
like that?
That's actually, it's funny that you say that because after I'm done, like, I feel like I have nothing else to say unless, like, until, like, a bunch of other things happen. So
a new book is contingent upon life experience for you.
Yeah, yeah. I think absolutely, absolutely. And, like, I'm constantly, like, taking, like, notes in, like, you know, a ton of different places and then, like, trying to, like, find them. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And it's pretty accurate, actually.
I'm wondering... You know, you write about yourself. Have you thought about taking yourself entirely out of some of these projects? Or is this just really the only way you can approach the act of writing? It has to be from you as the vessel, the body and embodiment of personal experience.
I mean, if I could, I would be writing, like, crime novels.
Do you read a lot of mysteries? Or?
I read a lot of, yeah.
What have you read lately?
I've actually stopped since I got pregnant.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with, like, anything forensic.
Oh, really?
So, like, all of John Douglas and Robert Ressler and those guys. I mean,
my partner has a master's in forensic science, and she's a huge mystery geek. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. My best friend from growing up is a forensic psychologist.
Yeah.
So, but I get so wrapped up in it, and it really fucks with my head. So
how so? Is it the actual...
I can't sleep with, like, the lights off. I get, like, really paranoid. I mean, I'm pretty paranoid by nature, I think, because I've read all of these books.
Yeah.
I mean, it really, like, takes, like, a serious toll on me.
It's sort of like the Law and Order thing, too.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I love Jonathan and Faye Kellerman. I'm huge fans of theirs. I've actively, and like I'll watch like serial killer documentaries like for hours.
Oh, have you read Sarah Paretsky out of curiosity?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Well, what's
Well, the V.I. Warshawski novels, which I'm wondering if you read those. They're very like a foul.
Is it true crime or?
No,
it
it's a mystery, but it's like a foul mouthed detective woman. You would actually,
ooh,
yeah, you would actually
that
like.
Sounds
there was
really
a really
good.
Terrible Kathleen Turner movie, but the books themselves are really good.
That sounds yeah. something like something I would enjoy.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
think so.
But it really, I mean, it fucks me up. So, and I maybe like it's really bad for the baby.
Oh, at what month in the pregnancy did you stop reading crime novels? Because you figured that some of the deviancy that you were reading about would filter into the womb.
And watching, too. Like, watching.
Wow, visuals, yeah.
But I was watching the Jeffrey Dahmer documentary, which is, I mean, incredible. And then, like, I couldn't sleep for, like, 3 days, you know? Because I get, like, really obsessive, and I just, like, keep doing it for hours and hours on end, like with the Law and Order in the book. I think it's like the psychopathy that really does my head in.
You need to go to a sort of extreme position to, I guess, keep yourself alive in terms of your view of humanity? Is that sort of it? Or?
I don't know. I mean, I never thought about it like that. Maybe. But if I could write that stuff, I probably would. But it scares the shit out of me, so I don't. I think I don't remember somebody really important. Maybe it was James Baldwin, who, you know, is one of like my heroes, said, you know, you write what you know.
Yeah.
And I think that for me, like, I'm not really capable of writing anything else. Like, I write from a place that is really genuine, and I've been super influenced by comedy and stand-up, which I actually just started, like, getting into a little bit. So
yes.
That's been hilarious. But I think, you know, you do what you know how to do. And this is the challenge is always getting everybody else as interested in me as I am in myself, I guess.
Well, I mean, but on the other hand, this might actually be the ultimate safeguard for excessive solipsism. Because if you go into, say, like, you know, a crime lab, or you go into the morgue, or you go into a hospital and you talk to these people and you see the process, then, I mean, it almost seems to me like you're almost at this point where if you were to do that, you would actually completely divest yourself of the self, and you would actually have things you would know about, but you wouldn't actually have to put yourself into it. So I'm wondering, why, Periel, why are you... I think you're afraid. I think your fearlessness, here is an opportunity, Periel.
I think that if I went into the morgue, which I would love to do, so if you know anybody who can grant me access to the morgue.
You could call around. You could talk your way. If you really want to go.
I think that if I went into the morgue, I would be writing in the same exact voice that I write everything else. It's not a bad idea. Maybe I'll go into the morgue.
But I mean, you know, if you have been watching Law and Order and reading mystery novels as long as it seems you have, then you know, my question is well, why use this as escapism? Why put this barrier? Why not just go into it and actually check it out?
Because it would like ruin my life. I mean, because then I wouldn't be capable of doing anything else. Like, I would just become, I mean, just in so enthralled and obsessed in like the darkest depths of like humanity. I mean, it would.
But that stuff's interesting.
It is interesting. Yeah. But, I mean, at the expense of what? Like, my sanity?
Well, this makes no sense. Because here you have, you describe in this book, you know, a lot of the sexual flings you have. And, hey, I kissed a girl and all this kind of stuff. And it's sort of like, well, okay, if you're going to put your money where your mouth is, then why not go ahead and try other forms of transgressive human behavior. I mean, you have a very clear command of yourself when you're writing about these other transgressive things that you've experienced. And I'm saying, you know, you could probably do it for something like this as well. I guess I'm trying to encourage you to do bad things, which is probably a good thing.
I'm sort of like imagining myself walking into this funeral home on Bleecker Street with a baby carriage. I mean, like, can I hang out here for a few weeks?
You know, but I'll tell you. So I mean, I did this recently. So I do a lot of like walking, and I do this sort of journalism where I do long walks and walk into places. If I happen to walk past a live poultry market. I had never gone into a live poultry market. I walked in there and I started interviewing the guy. And I'm a carnivore. And I love chickens. And I'm sitting here and the guy's saying, you know, basically 3/4 of the chickens in here are going to be completely dead by the end of the day. And he was, he let me photograph him in front of the chickens, but then he showed me like he had all these scratches from the chickens that on his arms, but he wouldn't let me photograph that.
Why not? So,
because he just didn't want people to know about this, even though he's like, he recognizes this is a tough job. But I found this all really fascinating, and my voice, my sense of morality, all that was not really compromised. It was just another perspective to add so that I can kind of get beyond myself. And I'm wondering, you know, that's why I'm sort of suggesting or
did you kill a chicken?
I did not kill a chicken.
Why not?
That's not my thing. Let the butcher do it.
Well, I would argue that, like, based on what you're telling me, you should have been killing those chickens.
I was on a walk from the top of Staten Island, and I walked all the way into West Orange that day. That's like 30 miles, all right? So, you know, if I had had the time, perhaps I would have. But I have no desire to butcher a chicken. Yet at the same time, that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm not going to, you know, most people are not even going to go into the live poultry market. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have special cutting techniques. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make here...
That's sort of fascinating.
It is. But the point I'm trying to make here is that if you were to walk into these places, uh-huh. you wouldn't necessarily compromise your apparelness, so to speak.
Oh, no. I mean, I'm never concerned about compromising my apparelness, as you say.
Apparelosity?
It's interesting, though. I mean, like, where those lines are, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, like, for you, it's, you're going to go into the...
Why not?
But you're not going to kill a chicken.
But that's...
Like, if I went into the morgue, like, I would want to be, like, I think, cutting the bodies open, like, taking the eyeballs out. Like,
you do have to go to school for those kinds of things. You do realize this.
I mean, whatever. Not, you know,
it's
I
not
mean,
just like, hey, can you hold this?
It is, though, if, like, you know, the person in charge...
So what I'm getting at here is the reason why you don't go into these places is because you want to have full hands-on involvement at all times.
I think honestly, like, all kidding aside, I think with, like, all of that dark stuff, it really does scare me. Like, I don't know how deep can you fall before, like, all bets are off and, like, the game is over. I mean, that stuff really does. I just wrote a piece about the Jodi Arias case. And, I mean, it really, like, I get, like, really obsessed with that psychological stuff. It's, like, really, really intense. Which, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe it's all the reason to just dive right in.
Yeah. But, I mean, you can still get a very strong sense of what something is like even by observing it and asking the right questions. I have found, anyway.
I sort of like to get my hands dirty. I mean, I like to get in there, and if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it all the way.
So you... But then what about aspects of life in which you can't do that? I mean, you know, why...
Like what?
Well, like... Jumping out of an airplane or something.
No interest.
No interest.
Zero.
Yeah.
Sounds like the stupidest, worst idea in the fucking world.
Or like, you know, if you want to understand why someone obsessively collects trains or something like that.
Not interested.
So you can't find any interest if it's not something that you if you can't do it, you can't find any interest.
No, it's not that if I can't do it, it's that, like, I'm like all or nothing. Like, I'm either obsessed or pretty indifferent.
Yeah.
And, you know, the psychological stuff, I get pretty obsessive. I'm not sure it's that healthy.
You write, doctors are fucking shady. They're just as shady, if not more shady, than everybody else.
Uh-huh.
How much of this do you think is informed by this hygienist who you identify as Leslie Myron, in which you suggest that she killed her husband? Well, my question to you is, you know, first of all, did you contact the police or, like, do any further investigation, possibly hire a private investigator to look into this? Or
I'm not the one who suggested that she killed her husband. The New York Times,
did, yes.
Suggested that she killed her husband. And I don't think that she's shady at all. She was awesome. I mean, if she killed her husband, I fully believe that it was because he was abusive in some way. That's just my personal...
Justifiable murder.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
So in what conditions is homicide justifiable to you?
It's law self-defense.
And order, self-defense.
Self-defense. But, yeah, I mean, my position that doctors are shady has nothing to do with the fact that my hygienist may or may not have murdered her husband.
You've never found a jovial doctor?
No, I have great doctors. I have amazing doctors, but...
You can never completely trust them.
I mean, they're human beings, you know, like they wake up in the morning, they have bad breath, they take a shit, they get drunk, they fight with their partners. I mean, they're, you know, they have gambling problems and drug problems and make like bad decisions just like anyone else. I mean, I don't trust these people implicitly, you know, I mean, they're human.
And so every doctor is a wild gambler and drinker and is going.
No, you're putting words in my mouth.
No, I'm trying to understand.
I didn't say
this,
that. Yeah. I didn't say every doctor. I just said that, like, I approach doctors with the same skepticism that I approach everything else. I mean, you need, I'm not going to just trust you to like cut me open or pull something out of my mouth or my body because you're a doctor. You could forget to like sew me back up or leave an instrument inside of me, or you could be crazy.
So you need to absolutely thoroughly investigate someone. I mean, just, I mean, how many hours do you have to spend with a doctor? Like, particularly if you're having a baby. Mm-hmm. So on the obgen side, what kind of prep do you do to find the right thing? Is there like a 4-hour hoedown session to make sure
there's
that
there's a lot of research? Yeah. There's a lot of background research, and I have not hired a private investigator, but it's not something that I'm beyond or that I haven't considered, or I don't think it's a great idea.
If you think that, I'm going to go ahead. If you think I should slaughter chickens, you should hire a private investigator. Hey, you see?
You might be right. I think that people really sort of blindly trust doctors. And I think it's a really dangerous thing to do.
So you're talking more about belief culture. It's not necessarily doctors who are shady, but all humans are capable of deceit, terrible things, and we shouldn't implicitly trust our faith in just anybody.
Yeah, but I think that, like, your life is in your hands to a certain degree when you're dealing with doctors, you know? And, like, you can get talked into a whole bunch of different things because you have this quote-unquote, like, expert. And, like, maybe that's true, but, I mean, I guess what it really comes down to, regardless of doctor, lawyer, whatever, I mean, you should be informed.
Yeah.
And you should inform yourself, and you should do the research on your own.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether you're killing chickens or, you know, investigating.
I'm wondering why that wasn't as pronounced in the book, because I'm totally with you on that. Just by saying doctors are shady and I don't know about them. But
it was pronounced in the book. There's a whole section on Dr. Zarkin.
Yes, of course.
I mean, that was sort of to illustrate that point.
But what I mean to say is, and this is, seems to be, at least what I was reading this.
Also.
Yes, of course,
there
the
are a couple of really clear examples of what happens when you blindly just trust your doctor.
But, of course, sometimes one might argue that you can blindly trust in some. I mean, I saw a therapist recently. It was blind trust. It worked out for a little bit. And then I didn't need the therapist anymore. But that was blind trust. And what the therapist did in the early sessions worked. You know? So I mean, sometimes. I mean, I guess my question here
is. You don't have that much at stake, though, going to see a therapist. I mean.
Well, one's sanity. One's ability to actually be
sanguine.
No, I mean,
if you're going to see, like, a psychiatrist and like you might be like schizophrenic, I would say that there's a lot more at risk, and you know you're being prescribed like 4 different like antipsychotic medications and electric shock therapy.
Well,
there's a lot
I
more
see your
at
distinction
stake.
Your distinction is when you're having someone who is putting pills into your body or actually slicing and dicing you up. I agree with you, but the thing is there are different types of doctors who don't do that. You know, and that actually don't prescribe you and dope you up with meds, mm-hmm. and actually like therapy and things like that.
Well, that's sort of like a vibe, right? Like that's cool. I mean, that's fine. It's therapists can also be serial killers.
Of course, anybody could. Potentially. So, I have to ask you. You wrote on the Ho to Go website that you have always been a sort of outsider insider in the world of fashion, and you also write that you had to be an outsider because you had refused to kowtow to convention. Here we are meeting in a place which kind of almost epitomizes this contradiction. Why do you feel the need to belong in some sense? I mean, I know plentiful outsiders who just don't give a fuck about any kind of group. They find fellow outsiders who may share common interests, but it's not in any kind of, well, let's find the appropriate club or organization or group with which to curry favor for our particular. I mean, I'm curious about this and how and why you need that.
I don't know if it's something that I actively sought out as much as it's sort of a fact, or always has been a fact of my life. I have always sort of done my own thing and followed like whatever sort of sense of, I mean, justice for, you know, things that are in the political or social arena. And I think that the more mainstream media or world has like found me before I actively sought it out. Like I don't think like I ever set out to try to be anything other than myself, quite frankly. But the truth is that like I'm not really wholly entirely part of, I have my fingers in a lot of different things. So maybe that has something to do with it. You know, like I've always been interested in fashion and comedy and design and writing. So
there cannot really be, in other words, a full true blue outsider. There can't, it, I mean, if you want to at least get something going that gets recognition, you can't really be an outsider. I mean, this whole insider-outsider thing, I mean, this to some degree, I guess, is that. But I mean, like you, I've never really courted that particular attention. I mean, I guess the question is, why should these distinctions even matter? Why, if one is essentially one's true nihilistic self that happens to be recognized by a few people and you're able to do what you like, why should the distinctions matter?
Again, I don't know if they matter so much as it's, you know, I mean, for me, like an observation of my life. I mean, it just seems to be sort of like a fact, you know? I mean, I sort of go in between several different worlds. I mean, I think that if you're an artist, and I don't know that I would consider myself an artist, but I would consider myself, you know, someone who works in the arts, let's say, or a writer. That is a very solitary thing.
Yeah.
And it's something that, I mean, I consciously pull myself outside of everything else and go lock myself in a room for 6 months or 9 months or whatever it is. And I'm alone. And I'm functioning and working like outside of, you know, everything else.
The question though,
and then you have to go inside in order to do something with it, right?
Yeah,
I mean, if you want, like, I'm not just writing like a diary, right? So,
but I'm wondering though if that's also temperamental, because you do describe this period where you are basically in your grandmother's apartment, pretending to be your grandmother so you could pay the $1,000 a month in rent. But
that was just depression.
That was depression.
That was
okay.
Just depression.
Okay. But I mean, and of course, you move later on into this walk-up apartment,
uh-huh.
In which, well, if I lived in a walk-up that high, it would have to be something extraordinarily enticing for me to actually, you know, to cure me of my laziness, mm-hmm. because there's so many damn stairs. And you have the hallway laden with trash.
It was something extremely enticing. It was like a little slice of heaven for me.
A slice of heaven to just... basically, if anybody wanted to meet you, they would have to go through this labyrinth in order to actually get you.
No. I mean, I think it was just to have something of your own, you know, to build something that was wholly mine. And especially after coming out of, like, the wreckage of a breakup,
yeah.
And, you know, that fucking apartment in Stuyvesant Town, which, you know, the irony, of course, was, you know, I wanted that apartment my whole life. I thought it was, like, the greatest thing in the world. And then I lived there.
Is this related to the whole Manhattan thing? Or?
Yeah, I think so. I do. My father grew up in downtown Manhattan. And, yeah, 100%. I grew up going to the East Village when the East Village was still, like, pretty funky. And was just, you know, it was like a whole other world for me. And I always wanted to live in the East Village. And I actually had for a while previous to my grandmother dying. But I think that, well, that apartment really was significant in the sense that, like, I had to build that entire thing for myself from scratch. And I think that the very act of that was incredibly therapeutic.
What about the couch? I mean, this is extremely curious to me because it is an object with which you project a good deal of family history.
Mm-hmm.
And then the great irony is that you eventually get rid of the couch, and for this book, you actually have to purchase the couch back, which is kind of comparable to, well, I'm now writing a book based off of my family history, and I'm exploiting it in some sense for my labor, or for cash, or for money. You know, it's almost as if this couch is an ineluctable part of your life. And I'm wondering about this. I mean, why do you, in this case, did you need, like, an object with which to, I suppose, project much of your family history to kind of see some of the connections over the years and why, and also sitting on this couch too, and of course there's the other guy who jerks off on the couch, but I mean but it seems to me that the image I have had of you while reading this book was you sitting on this couch, more so than anything that is on the cover. It was more just you trying to sit on the couch and figure out what the hell's going on. So why did you need a couch, do you think?
Why did I need a couch?
For this.
In the book?
Well, in the book, but also in your life. I mean, to just sort of get a sense of your own identity.
Again, depression. I mean, I don't know. Like, the couch was the central place to sit. I mean, I think also, though, there is this... I mean, there was an aesthetic thing also.
The sort of throne-like nature of it, because it was the biggest object in the walk-up apartment?
That's actually interesting. I never thought about my narcissism as it relates to the couch, but maybe. No, I think that, you know, when my grandmother died, everybody wanted something, and, like, I wanted the couch. So, which I got. But I think, again, like, you know, you always, you never know, or what you think you want is not actually what you want until you get it, and, you know, all that bullshit. I mean...
Well, what's your first memory of that couch?
My entire childhood. I mean, I just have, like, an image. Like, every time I walked into my grandmother's apartment, she was sitting in the same spot on that couch. And she would have never given it to me, is the thing. Like, another grandmother might have been like, oh, darling... I know how much you love this couch. I've had it for like 900 years. You just graduated from college. You got your own apartment. Why don't I give you my couch?
So it seems to me that, like, the major...
It was a challenge, pretty much.
Well, it was a challenge, but it seems to me, like, we were talking earlier about how you look to your grandmother on basically how to speak your mind,
mm-hmm.
how to go after something no matter what. And that couch is, I think, also tied up in this
mm-hmm.
idea. Your grandmother, I'm guessing, based off of reading the book and talking with you, only for a mere hour after several years, that this is perhaps one of the more prominent figures in your life, to the model for how you learn how to live as an adult.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I think that was definitely not how I wanted to live. I think that I learned a lot from her, and she was great in a lot of different ways, but I definitely did not want to be like her or to live like she lived. I think that, and I think I say this in the book as well, I think that my grandparents and my family in general live a pretty safe life. I mean, everybody's, like, pretty risk averse. And I think that I'm probably, like, the only one who really took, like, a pretty sharp turn from that. My grandmother was not who I wanted to be ever.
But, I mean, also, I wanted to ask you, I mean, you really go out of your way to demonize your aunt
mm-hmm.
in this book. You know, you call her an outright bitch.
Mm-hmm.
You describe her piling on all this stuff onto a bagel, and I was reading this going, wow, I mean, if it were me, all families have loathsome members, but you have to at least try to find something positive about them. And
why because, don't I have enough shit to do?
Well, it's part of being human and not going to those demonizing kind of
Well, I think a couple of things. I mean, I think that first of all, you know, these are characters in a book. And I think that, you know, you have, like, a certain amount of time to write and make a point. And my point with that character was not to make her sympathetic in any way. And real life might be a little bit different, but that's neither really here or there. Quite frankly, I think that, you know, people who are complaining about how they've been portrayed should be thanking me for the things that I didn't put in the book.
You still were basically in. If someone is dealing with grief, they're going to go ahead and possibly eat a little bit more, or they're going to act very strangely.
Grief had nothing to do with that, trust me. Grief had nothing to do with that. There was no grief involved there. No grief. And, you know, again, like, everybody's, like, free to go write their own book and
because you have to actually write the book. You have to get an agent. You have to get it published.
Go for it.
Yeah, but I mean, to rectify one wrong, I mean, that just seems to be excessive.
It's not, I don't see it like that. I mean, I don't see it like that. You know, my position, and I think that something that I take really seriously as somebody who writes based on nonfiction, certain things have been changed. Because I've had to legally, but because of the publisher and et cetera, et cetera. My first loyalty is to my work, and I would never repeat anything that was said to me in confidence. Like, I would never break that sort of vow of silence between, like, a friend or a family member. But in terms of people's behavior that I find loathsome, don't act like that in front of me and I won't write about you. I don't pretend to be like a baker.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what I do, you know?
But I'm not writing
like a sitcom for NBC.
Sure, but I think that you could hypothetically call the book, because it's such a long process, it's 2 years, there is a bit of a baking going on. And so you do have some time to think, well, maybe I shouldn't characterize someone in this particular light, maybe I should give them a fair shot. I mean, at one point, Hannah even says to you, "I'm a loser in love. Oh, God, you're going to make me look like a loser in love in your book. You better not." So what does a friend have to do to, I guess, not be written about? I mean, it seems to me that if I were writing about someone and I really, like, had strong feelings and it was going to be a published book, I would think twice, maybe three times, maybe four times before I go ahead and you know, throw them into the off the cliff, you know?
Again, I don't see it like that. I don't feel like I'm throwing anybody off a cliff. As Hannah was saying that, I was sitting in front of her with a pen and a paper taking notes.
So by virtue of being a stenographer in front of her, that's...
Hannah knew exactly what I was writing the entire time. Again, like, I think everybody has their lines of that they feel are appropriate or inappropriate, and I sleep very well with the decisions that I've made. I don't think that I'm throwing anybody off of a cliff. In fact, like, quite the opposite. I think that people should maybe have, like, a little bit of a sense of humor about themselves and not take it so seriously. Nobody I don't think I reveal more about anybody else than I do about myself.
That defends. I see.
It's not a defense. I mean, this is, you know, you're asking me a question. Like, I'm telling you, you know, these are the, you know, the quote unquote rules that, like, I operate by.
How do you find empathy? I mean, can you find empathy? Can you forgive some of these people at all?
I don't have anything against any of them. I mean, this is not written with, like, malicious intent. I really do hope that, like, everybody has a sense of humor about themselves. I think that, like, if anybody should be mortified, it's probably me. The stories that I think I tell about myself are much worse. I don't think, like, you know, acting like an asshole at, like, a Shiva call is that big of a deal. Like, I actually think it's kind of a funny scene. And I do. I really do think that people should, you know, don't take it that seriously. It's not that big of a deal, you know. It's not like your picture and your, like, bank account number is plastered on, like, a billboard in Times Square.
We're not talking Facebook status, but I guess my feeling is, as though, I'm kind of curious about if there is a line between what one says about someone online or something and what one publishes about another person online, or in a book rather.
I mean, again, you know, I don't I have no idea about online, you know, or Facebook or any of that stuff. I mean, I don't even think about that. I would never post something with, again, malicious intent I just don't operate that way. But this is a book, it's a story, and this is a character in that story, and it's might be fucked up, but it was fucked up, and it's also funny, you know? Like, I don't take it that seriously, and I don't think that I'm revealing anything that would, you know, cause somebody, like, to lose their job or, you know, anything that has serious ramifications. I mean, I would never do that. I mean, maybe unless somebody did something really horrible to me. I mean, I'm not a vengeful person by nature. And I think people should really just loosen up. Like, it's not that big of a deal.
So if you were including perhaps more stories about other people in the book, are you more inclined to tell more revealing or embarrassing episodes about yourself, out of curiosity? Do you have any kind of balance?
No, I mean, I'm not, like, weighing things out like that, you know? I mean, I think that I write about things that are compelling to me, and I feel, like, very flattered and humbled that other people also enjoy reading my work. Like I said, again, like, I think my biggest inspiration has always been comedy and stand-up. And I think that if you can't find humor in yourself and in the flaws that you have and in how fucked up your family is, and that, like, you know, my aunt was, you know, piling food onto a bagel or being a bitch, or I call her a cunt or whatever it is.
It was a bitch, not a cunt.
There might be a cunt when thrown in there somewhere.
There was a cunt, I think, later on, but not in the passage we're referring to.
It's not that serious, you know? I mean, it's really not that big of a deal. I think that I think that there's also, like, this very romantic notion of being written about, like Hannah. And yes, I do think if I'm sitting in front of you taking notes while you're telling me these things, like, actually...
I'm going to start taking notes right here for my book, Periel.
I mean, with permission, then yeah, like, that does, like, sort of open the room in a different way. And then this is my perception, you know, it's my book, it's my story, like, you don't have to agree with it, you know, you don't even have to read it, you know, and, like, you also don't have to take me that seriously, like, I'm good with that.
Then how serious should you be taken? How serious should any of what you do be taken?
I mean, I don't think that that's for me to say. Like, I don't think that that's my judgment. I think that, you know, the people who read my work or can make that assessment on their own. Maybe not that fucking seriously. Like, I'm not, you know, like, constructing, you know, the Twin Towers from scratch, you know?
Then we, like, need to go ahead and go after that mutual friend who introduced you as a great writer, because then we can't take that, you know.
Well, that would have been Mikhail Baryshnikov, yeah. So you can feel free to call him up and
I will. Let's see if we can get him on air for this, to describe
go
why.
Go for it.
Do you think that your mother's judgment of you, which we see in that email criticizing your hair, what you wear, talking with food in your mouth, I mean, is this some kind of genetic legacy? I mean, do you judge other people as a way of surviving sometimes? Or?
I don't know. I think that I don't know how much I judge other people in earnest, you know, when it really comes down to it. I think that there is the book, and then there's my life. And, you know, I think that I am pretty aware that we're all pretty flawed, myself included, you know? So, I mean, I'm not, like, it's not like judgment day around here. I think that those things are pretty fluid and contextual and circumstantial. I mean, I'm a tough critic, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But...
Well, actually, I mean, I wanted to talk about one thing you say, and this could actually answer some of these questions. You write, I decided that if I were going to see a therapist, I definitely needed a gay. I've been around the block enough times to know that there is only one thing straight men think about when they have a vulnerable, attractive woman in their clutches, blowjobs. Beyond that, straight men aren't exactly renowned for their listening skills. Well, I'm a straight man. The last six guests I've had on this program have all been women. I have not thought about blowjobs. I am a pretty good listener, I'd like to think, after 500 shows. So what of this weird kind of thing in 2013 of associating one's sexual orientation with one's professional capacity.
Well, Ed, I don't know if you're an exception to the rule, and that just means that what I'm saying is even more true. There's no way that, like, I can actually assess if, like, the thought of a blowjob with any of the 5 or 7 past guests that you have has really crossed your mind. So I'm just going to have to take your word for that.
It hasn't, because you see, there's these things called books, and there's these things called minds that, mm-hmm. that are also highly attractive mm-hmm. as well.
Right, but not those things can lead to thinking about blowjobs.
Not necessarily, not all the time, especially when one is happily partnered for 7 years.
Not necessarily, and not all the time. But I certainly maintain that putting yourself into a room with a random, strange, straight man and bearing your soul to him sets the ground for sexual... I mean, there's something sexual there, period, the end. Like I said, I've been around the block enough
but
times.
Is it because you have happened to encounter straight male therapists who have offered really weird sexual...
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. In fact, the only therapist, except for the one in the book, that I've ever gone to has been a woman. And she's never tried to sleep with me.
Does this relate back to the whole doctors are shady business? That it comes down to the fact that
they're all, human. They're human. I mean, it's not just a therapist. It's a human being. And, like, I'm not saying that, like, all your therapists are going to try to fuck you. But, like, I would just like to remove that element as even, like, a possibility in the air and go with a gay guy. I
keep my pornographic fantasies separate from a therapeutic environment, but that's just me, or separate from, like, a good conversation with somebody.
Yeah.
Because it has, I mean, you know.
I don't think those things are mutually exclusive. I would say that you might be a rare breed.
Maybe I have Asperger's.
Maybe. Or that.
That seems a good self-immolating way to end this conversation. Periel, I disagree with you on many points, but it was a pleasure to chat with you.
It's a pleasure to chat with you as well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Divine, the damned and the divine, they carry on, never denied, and the all sweet uptown.